Hello and welcome to the opening bell. My name is Matt Christie. We're back again.
We've been away for a while.
We have.
I've had stuff on.
Not been doing nothing, I hasten to add, but we have been away for a little while. Just a little bit tricky sometimes just to when we're both in the office to sit and do this. But anyway, let's speak about things that you're interested in, which no doubt is the Anthony Joshua Charles Martin fight this weekend. And we not long have returned from the weigh-in at the O2, which, thanks to the presence largely of Shannon Briggs, was incident filled. But away from that ludicrous pantomime sideshow.
So just to explain, Shannon Briggs obviously rolled up shouting, "Let's go, champ."
He was shouting at a few people. He even shouted at Lee Selby. which I wasn't sure whether he was, if he was offering Lee Selby out or just telling him to, let's go.
He's bitten off more than he could chew there. Lee Selby would outskill him.
I'd pick Lee Selby. Yeah. But so there was a bit of David Hay, Shannon Briggs shenanigans, predictably, there this afternoon. Other than that, though, Anthony Joshua looked composed, looked ready. You were lucky enough to spend a few minutes with him after the weigh-in, where you sat down and chatted to him one-on-one. What was he like? Was he relaxed? Any sign of nerves?
He was really relaxed. I was more nervous than he was. I'm not fighting for a heavyweight title tomorrow. And he just spent about, so they had the weigh-in, I guess he had all his TV stuff, and then there was a load, a pretty big crowd there, I'd say. It was in the same place as the Froch Kessler weigh-in.
It wasn't as big as that crowd, I don't think, but it was, it's pretty big.
Pretty big.
Friday afternoon,
And there was a lot, and there was a long line of people waiting for autographs and stuff. So he spent ages sort of just going down the line, signing, taking pictures, all this kind of stuff. So by the time I spoke to him, he seemed pretty tired, but kind of perfectly relaxed for someone who has their life-defining fight coming up in a little over 24 hours.
When the fight was first announced, there's the obvious scorn put on the contest as probably almost out of sympathy for Tyson Fury and how this particular title, the IBF belt, was taken from him.
Yeah.
And then the nature in which Charles Martin won it. So there's been a lot of people saying this isn't the true world heavyweight title fight, which I completely understand and I'm on board with to an extent. However, it is the IBF title, which was initially claimed in 1983, I believe, by Larry Holmes. So it's got some heritage. And if it wasn't the heavyweight division, and if Tyson Fury didn't have another title, and a British fighter was going for an IBF belt, we'd all be behind it, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But besides that, we've got a guy called Charles Martin, who, to the public at large, was probably still pretty much unknown. To boxing insiders, the vast majority of, he's still an unknown quantity. There's a question mark hanging over his head in that he could rise to the occasion tomorrow and really give Anthony Joshua some problems. However, it's hard to get away from the feeling that this is written in the stars that Joshua is going to win. And with all the evidence we've got, and that's all you can use in situations like this, is evidence, is that Joshua is just a better fighter. Quite substantially so, it seems.
Yeah. So like before this week, I was thinking, like you say, Martin is an unknown quantity in that, he hasn't been tested in his fights. He's unproven. We don't quite know what he's going to bring. He seems perhaps a bit erratic. So I was thinking, this could be a dangerous fight and harder than people expect. But all this week has done, I've seen more footage of Martin training. You can't read much into the public workouts, but, he still didn't look that good. Joshua just seems bigger, stronger, and the better boxer.
Because we don't know enough about Charles Martin, perhaps, because we haven't seen Charles Martin really beat a top operator or seen him in any real trouble of which he's got to deal with. Are we perhaps being a bit too kind to Joshua? And let's not forget, it was only a few months ago that he had that iffy period against Dillian White. And he did look in trouble in the second round. I watched that round again recently, and there was a point in that second round where he was very, very uncomfortable. Are we just forgetting about all that and discounting White a little too handily?
Martin. You forgetting his name.
Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm perhaps more guilty than most with how much I've discounted.
But like you said, you've got to go on the evidence you've got available. And, you know, Dillian did catch Joshua with a big shot towards the end of the second round. So I was certainly guilty of discounting Dillian before that fight. I thought Joshua would win it, you know, a lot more comfortably than it was in reality. But perhaps the encouraging sign from that fight against Dillian White was we've used this term to talk about other boxes, but Joshua's sort of crisis management seemed a bit better than it was in the amateurs. Like from the bouts I saw in the amateurs, I've never seen him get stopped or dropped, but I have seen him get caught by big shots and be in a bit of two minds whether to fight back or tuck up or defend himself, leave himself open and just leak, you know, a few more points, which in three rounds is very risky. Whereas against White, in that, you know, highly pressurised environment, I thought he handled the heavy shot quite well. You know, it hit him, it must have hurt, but he sort of tucked up, stepped in, and didn't really let any more, and sort of just rode out the storm, which is probably an encouraging sign.
Yeah, you would. Yeah, I take that. I take that on board. I mean, there's a really, really extensive preview in this week's issue, in this week's Boxing News, where I try to go into detail about most aspects of the fight. And one of them is I try and identify the best performances of each. And I say in that, and it doesn't give too much away, the preview is that probably Joshua's best and worst performance was rolled into one against.
That's a good point, which I thought when reading your article, Matt.
Yeah. I didn't mean yet. Yeah. Brilliant.
Natch.
I mean so he, in a way, because it looked at the same time in that fight against Dillian White, at the end of the first round, you were just like, oh my God, this is going to be over in the second, and it's going to be over with Joshua's arms raised.
Yeah.
So you could look at it two ways. You could say that if it did go that way, if he was a little bit more careful about his work, because let's face it, he was fighting out of character. He was fighting like an angry young man in that second round. That's when he got tagged. So let's say he didn't do that and he just walked through Dillian White in the second round and it was all over. You'd be even more convinced that he was going to beat Charles Martin. However, you say that, at least we have got some evidence at last. You and I have been doing this podcast for quite a long time now, and many, many times we've spoke about Anthony Joshua, and prior to the Dillian White fight, it was always, okay, well, what happens when he gets tagged, and what happens when he has to go rounds? Okay, he didn't go 12 against Dillian White, and it wasn't a shot for, okay, it wasn't like a massive haymaker that he got caught flush with, but it was a good shot he didn't see coming, and in that seventh round the finish was something else.
Yeah,
for a guy like that, very,
after
very impressive.
A hard fight to deliver that knockout.
So he's far from invincible. I believe that he's far from invincible. He's not the second coming of Mike Tyson. He hasn't got that aura about him. He's not the finished article. But he's shown enough to me to suggest that he will thrive at the next level. And, I mean, the next question, is Charles Martin at that next level? Is Charles Martin any better than Dillian White? The footage that I'd seen of Dillian White prior to the Joshua fight and the footage that I've seen of Charles Martin prior to the Joshua fight, I'd probably pick Dillian White to beat Charles Martin as well.
I can see that. But I do think, yeah, I can see that, but I do think Martin's a very different style to Dylan White, and you know, and I don't know if that's going to be a style that Joshua finds harder or easier to deal with on Saturday. My hunch is that Martin might be a step up from Dylan, but you know, maybe Joshua will win the fight, will win it better because he sort of learned from the last one. Like, he was just today, he was talking about how, you know, that he feels calm now, but he was saying, the key, you know, I've got, you know, we'll see how it is on fight night. I've got to sort of deal with the nerves on fight night. You know, the reference, the implication being that last time around, once he was, once he was finally in the ring with Dylan, all sort of whatever went out the window and he just went for him to knock him out. So he's got it to sort of keep his cool with this big, big prize, you know, on the line for him. And I sort of see what people say when, you know, Tyson Fury is the man who beat Vladimir Klitschko, the division number one. So, but this belt is still significant because it was sort of, yes, the IBF stripped it from him very quickly, but at least it was sort of following their own rules.
Yeah, yeah.
So it wasn't sort of a shifty move.
It's worth
saying
that, yeah.
And, you know, yes, Glasgow's knee went out against Charles Martin, but, you know, it wasn't like it was a bad, you know, that's just the rules. Then he's, you know, he's the champion, and maybe he would have, probably would have won it anyway. So it's not like he then got, you know, a bad decision to end up with the title. So it's sort of, it's fair that Martin has the IBF heavyweight championship in that sense. So it is a significant fight, an important fight, but obviously we're not going to know who the best heavyweight on planet Earth is until Wilder, you know, Deontay Wilder, Tyson Fury, and the winner of Martin Joshua sort of sort that out over the next year or two.
Ideally, what happens to, let's stop saying what happens when, what let's stop presuming that Joshua wins. Because we're gonna look, in a matter of, about 30 hours time, we could look absolutely ridiculous if people are listening back to this after the event and Joshua's been chinned in two rounds.
I'm gonna be looking absolutely ridiculous in about 2 hours time.
Let's
Friday night. I'll get my party visor on.
You're going nuts tonight.
Oh, I'll be in Reflex, listening to the Baywatch theme tune.
It's been a while since I've accompanied you in Reflex. That was memorable, and probably not the time to reminisce now. But so let's go back to the fight. You've got Joshua against Martin. Now, if there was no belt on the line, it'd be
a good fight.
It'd be a good, worthwhile fight. The winner would go into the lower echelons of the top 10, you'd say, of the heavyweight division. What would be the ideal next fight for the winner? I think if it's Charles Martin, the fact that he's gone from winning the title via rather inconclusively, you'd have to say, the fact that he's done that and then he's gone straight into the Anthony Joshua fight does suggest that if Martin wins, he's gonna aim for a different opponent than Joshua will. If Joshua wins, you'd think that Martin would go straight for, right, there's no feeling out period, I don't need any more education, come on Tyson Fury, hit me.
Yeah.
He's just gonna be whatever he can get in terms of the big names. Joshua, you sense, might, and boxing does always surprise us, doesn't it? So, but you do sense that Joshua will go along the lines of, you've got the IBF Takam against
Joseph Parker.
Joshua can probably get in a voluntary defence before he has to fight the winner of that bout.
Yeah.
And there are some other kind of learning fights he could take. Do we expect him to do that kind of route?
You know, I think that would be sensible, as in, you know, first defence, have it in a sort of, you know, have a glorious summer's day, have a an easier first defence than, you know, the sort of kind of thing that new world champions often do against someone in the top 10. There'll be someone there who would be quite good for that. I'm not quite sure. I don't know the top 10 off the top of my head. But you've had sort of the Deontay Wilder opponents, Johan de Halpas, and Eric Molina. Sorry, I'm laughing because I'm trying to remember what De Halpas's nickname is, and I can't, but my brain's telling me it's the potato, and I don't think it is, but it's something weird.
It is.
But what's his nickname?
The potato.
Anyway.
Definitely the potato.
So he finds the potato next. And then if Joseph Parker beats Carlos Takam, you know, that's a good fight. Parker has been, looks pretty, I've only seen a few clips of him as a pro, so I can't give like a fully informed opinion, but he looks pretty good. He's from New Zealand, which is sort of a selling point if he follows my advice and does a hacker in the ring before every fight, which I don't think he does, but he should. But he looks pretty, like the clips I've seen, he looks pretty fast for a heavyweight, but maybe his promoters have speeded up that footage.
I think Parker looks good. I think Parker looks decent. I really do. I've always thought Parker looks like a solid prospect who will evolve into a contender, and I'd probably expect him to beat Takam. And then that's a nice fight. I think Joshua Parker is a nice fight. There's also people like Derek Chisora in and around that top 10, that IBF top 10, which, again, you know, as Anthony Joshua as a world champion taking on Derek Chisora, who's quite adept at selling a fight, let's face it. He's yeah. All right at making things a little bit interesting before the event. You can imagine that would sell reasonably well as a voluntary defence. But how much of a surprise would it be to you, for example, if they were to make Fury against Joshua later this year?
Because that's exactly what Eddie Hearn, Joshua's promoter, was saying the day before yesterday. He was talking about fighting Fury sooner rather than later. He was talking about Joshua fighting Fury sooner rather than later, i.e. this year, whatever, September, October, something like that. Which surprised me to hear, because if I was Joshua's promoter, I'd be thinking, you know, as good as Anthony is right now, he's got a lot of improving to do. In a year's time, in 2017, he's going to be a better boxer. And if he does win this title, the fights he has next are going to be big, lucrative events for everyone concerned, because they've got a world championship attached. And the more that Tyson Fury and Joshua tweet insults at each other, the more interest in the fight is going to build and build and build. Not that it wouldn't be huge anyway, but, you know, why rush it?
Is there an argument, though, because the fight would be huge, if Joshua looks $1 million tomorrow, say he wins in, I don't know, two, three rounds or something, doesn't put a hand or foot wrong, and wins in showreel style, the knockout is just, you know, of the one punch variety and everything else. Is there an argument to be made that there is no bigger fight to make in Britain at the moment, so why not make it now when it can happen, rather than run the risk, and let's go back to what we were saying before, this is boxing, things can happen.
Yeah.
Why run the risk of waiting until next summer, summer 2017, when one of them may have lost, one of them may have got injured, or whatever. You know, it's...
Yeah.
And I would imagine that is why people like Eddie Hearn are going, right, we'll make it now. And I mean...
I suppose that's the that kind of fight is the jackpot, isn't it?
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe we've seen fights like Amir Khan, Kell Brook, that seem to make sense on most levels just to make, and they go on and on and don't get made and drift away. So yeah, maybe that's why.
Okay, so it's certainly an interesting. Let's briefly go through, and we will do it briefly. Go through the undercard this weekend. So obviously Charles White and Anthony Joshua heading things. Right, Lee Selby, Eric Hunter.
Eric Hunter is an enemy of Boxing News now. We're idiots for calling Lee Selby the Welsh Mayweather.
Well, he's, you wonder about his... you wonder about Eric Hunter's persona, really, don't you? Well, not his persona, rather. You worry about his character a little
bit. Yeah, his personality.
Where you know, you feel, you know, you wonder if he's really in the right frame of mind for this fight, or if he'd ever be in the right frame of mind for this fight. Can he cause an upset against Lee Selby quickly, as concisely as you can?
He can. He's been angry all week. Apparently he was angry today. Maybe that means he's highly driven and highly motivated, or perhaps it means he's ruffled. So I think this might be a good fight, but I think the Welsh Mayweather's going to win on points.
Okay, right. This one's interesting. George Groves against David Brophy. I think it might even have been you actually that said it in the week. This is a fight that's got banana skin written all over it, and it would be a banana skin that would be under the foot of George Groves, obviously. Brophy wins this, he's jumped so many levels. But it's not beyond the realms that David Brophy could cause an upset here, is it?
I don't think it is. I think George Groves is the better boxer. He's been operating at a higher level, like, you know, world title level. But I think it's hard to sort of step down to domestic level fights. I think he's got an eye on bigger fights. So George isn't going to be as motivated for, you know, a bout for a minor title against someone he's completely expected to beat, to tee up a bigger fight in the summer that he's more interested in. So I can see this being harder than expected. I think Groves should probably, you know, should just be too technically gifted. I know Brophy hasn't that many knockouts on his record, but when I saw him fight, I remember thinking he hits hard.
Yeah.
I remember watching it and sort of hearing the sound of the punches. And
he's got one stoppage win from 16.
Yeah.
16.
But, you know, I wonder if that... My impression of watching him was that he could actually punch quite hard, but that, you know, maybe he sort of runs out of ideas against a journeyman who's tucking up. So I don't know, maybe this could be a harder than expected fight that Groves gets through.
You'd still expect Groves to get through it, wouldn't you?
Yeah, but if we're calling...
Could he have a Kenny Anderson style moment like he did a few years ago?
Yeah.
In fact, that was on a World Heavyweight title fight undercard as well, wasn't it? Oh my God, that's what's going to happen.
That is what's going to happen.
No, I mean, you think Groves would have too much, but Brophy's going to go into this just so determined and so much self-belief as well.
Yeah.
What an opportunity for him.
Yeah, I just have this feeling it could end up as being like a horrible fight that Groves doesn't really need right now.
Right, I hear you. Jamie McDonald, Fernando Vargas, that's all. She's the Fernando Vargas. So that's all Jamie McDonald, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know much about Vargas, but he has come in late, come in at short notice. So, you know, McDonald's sort of style is entertaining to watch. He chucks a lot of punches. He does get caught. So we'll see if this isn't a bit of a tear up. But I widely expect McDonald to win, and I think if you're calling like Matthew Macklin, Brian Rose sort of a 50-50 fight, I think the Groves Brophy fight could be the one where there's a surprise.
Okay, so let's move on. This is the one that interests me the most out of all the ones on the undercard, is Matthew Macklin against Brian Rose. The term crossroads fight fits this like a glove, really. It really is a crossroads fight. I think both have said lose this and they'll retire. The winner, you can make a case for just about clinging on to some kind of moving towards one last world title shot, something along those lines. The big question in this really is, it's about Macklin, isn't it? It's how much has Macklin got left? You would think if Macklin is the Macklin of 4 or 5 years ago, maybe even 2 or 3 years ago, he'd win this fight pretty comfortably. You'd pick him probably to stop Brian Rose. No offence to Brian Rose, but you, in terms of their styles and everything else, you would pick Macklin. Am I right?
Yeah, yeah. But is it a crossroads fight or is it something else? Is it a trampoline fight? If they're both on their way down and victory would relaunch the winner back up to the top, and if the loser misses the trampoline and hits the ground, it's game over. This is a new term I invented.
Yeah, so, I mean, at what point does... How do you miss the trampoline? So you're kind of fighting in midair?
So me and you are holding the trampoline.
Okay,
so... But and Matthew Macklin and Brian Rose are leaping off a building. So we're gonna, we've got to get that trampoline underneath one of them. He's gonna bounce back up to the top.
I understand the concept of them bouncing and then get flying back up. Yeah. I like that. I'm not convinced it will take off. I think it needs too much explaining, really.
What, trampoline fight?
It's a trampoline fight. No,
everyone talks about that in the pubs.
Okay. All right. So I mean. Who would you... I mean, you completely swerved the question.
That's what I do, Matt. That's what I do.
So would you have picked Macklin a few years ago, irrespective of whether there was a trampoline under them or not?
Yes, I would.
Would you pick Matthew Macklin now? Are you confident that Matthew Macklin has got... He said that for the... who did he fight? Jason Wellborn fight. His most recent outing, where he kind of struggled over the distance.
Yeah, I think he really struggled. And I think, you know, moving down to like middleweight, I think it was a mistake. It was he was just at this sort of advanced stage of his career, having to drain himself again. And it's just, so not only was that a mistake, but I think just making the decision in the first place raises question marks of uncertainty of where he's going. If he's back to his best, then I agree. You know, I think he'd be a clear favourite against Brian Rose. But the last time I saw Brian Rose, which I think was winning the rematch with Carson Jones, on the undercard.
That's better form, isn't it?
Yeah. So that, and you know, we know Brian Rose is a really good jab. Against Carson Jones, he was, you know, wading in to get a bit stuck in as well, which I thought was risky. But but he met him head on at times. So I do think it's a 50-50 fight. I really do. But I think Brian Rose is in better form.
I think Brian Rose is in better form. I just think some of the things that Matthew Macklin is saying, it's almost as if he's... I don't know, he's clinging to things. He's saying that he wasn't up for the Wellborn fight, even though a lot rode on that route as because prior to that, because there was talk of him retiring prior to that, and he thought, well, I'll go and give it another go. So he would have known how important that was, but he's saying that he wasn't quite mentally up for it. He didn't think in a million years that somebody like Jason Wellborn, and he says it all very respectfully, he didn't think that Jason Wellborn would be able to trouble him. Some of his sparring partners going into that bout were below him, and what have you. But the thing that kind of concerns me the most is that Macklin is an honest guy, and you feel that when he's saying, I've heard him say that, you know, I feel a lot more up for this, and he'll say, but ultimately, you know, I won't know what I've got left until I'm in the ring. And you almost feel like there's a little voice nagging away at the back going, telling him that he's already reached his peak, that he's on the descent,
and
there's something that is just telling me that Macklin knows this. But that doesn't mean to say that he's going to lose tomorrow night. You would expect, if anybody has witnessed Matthew Macklin at the peak of his career or whatever, you will know what unbelievable warrior Matthew Macklin is.
And he's been in some tremendous fights.
He really has.
Fights.
But we also should remember that I think it's getting on for 10 years now since that war with Jamie Moore, which was just one of the most astonishing fights I've ever seen in on British soil. And you know, you go through, you know, his fight, he's he went in through punishing fights in the lead up to his world title run, when he had a few world title fights, and then he went in with Felix Sturm, which was quite a grueling fight.
Great fight as well.
Yeah, again, Sergio Martinez, again, he had his moments to win that. Another grueling, grueling battle. And then you sent, for me, since that fight, he hasn't quite been the Matthew Macklin of old, which was, what, 2012?
What, for Sturm?
No, Martinez, which came after Sturm.
Yeah, I think that was 2012. So, and there was that brutal Golovkin body shot.
Yeah. And he's won. He had a couple of decent wins after Golovkin, but then he lost to Highland as well.
Yeah, and that was very unexpected.
Yeah, and you, at that point you kind of think, right, this is it now. So he would almost be defying logic if he was to look as good as he did 5 or 6 years ago tomorrow night. But he may not need to look as good as he did 5 or 6 years ago to win. It really does. And I hope I'm not being disrespectful to Brian Rose. Because, and this is the other thing as well, which played on my mind. I was listening to another podcast, and
what?
Yeah, there are others out there, believe it or not. And there was an interview with Brian Rose, and the things that he was saying were a lot more convincing than the things that Macklin has been saying. But to me, it's a fascinating fight. To me, that's the best one on the undercard.
Yeah, Macklin, I believe, has been out in LA sparring with Jason Quigley. He's a tremendous prospect.
Yes. Yeah.
So, you know, there's an outside chance he has sort of, you know, reinvented himself once again. But, yeah, I mean, this could be his sort of his last battle. And speaking of last battles.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful, wonderful.
What a link that was.
What a link that was. Let's just turn our attentions to Las Vegas for a moment and.
Sorry, I was just thinking about a potato.
A fighter some of you may have heard of, Manny Pacquiao, is taking part in what is supposed to be and what has been advertised as his final fight. He goes into battle against Timothy Bradley for the third time. It was a curious decision, a rather needless rubber match, you would say, in terms of their first two fights. But the closer he gets, I'm getting a little bit more excited about it. I think if you say that Pacquiao is on the decline, which he has been on a steady decline, but the level of it has perhaps been, or the perception of how far he's fallen has perhaps been exaggerated a bit by the fact that he lost fairly convincingly to Floyd Mayweather last year. Timothy Bradley apparently has been revamped under Teddy Atlas, so it's a bit more of a level playing field, you may think. And while we're talking about this being his last fight, if it is his last fight, and you feel like that he's been getting some stick, it's a far tougher outing than Floyd Mayweather's was.
Yeah.
When Floyd Mayweather went in against Andre Berto. Against Timothy Bradley, Pacquiao has picked out arguably one of the best pound-for-pound fighters who's still going, who's still out there.
You could say he's, what, the best in the welterweight division now?
Yeah, which is a pretty... That's a strong billing.
Yeah.
But what are we expecting from this fight? The first fight wasn't a classic. Pacquiao, me watching the TV, I thought Pacquiao won it comfortably. Two of the judges didn't. Scored it for Bradley, one of the most controversial decisions of all time.
I think Daniel Herbert, was he there for boxing?
Daniel Herbert was there. I think
he thinks it's one of the worst decisions he's ever seen, and he's seen a lot.
He's seen a lot, and that says it all. Daniel Herbert has been ringside for well over 20 years, ringside out in America for 20 years this year. I think one of his first was 1986, and he did name that as the worst decision he's ever seen. I think he scored it from memory something like 118 to 110. For Manny Pacquiao. There were a few people that agreed with the decision. Thomas Hauser was one who agreed that Timothy Bradley deserved to win that first one, but there is not many at all. I think you'd be talking like 95% of people thought that Pacquiao was robbed of that decision. The rematch, which would have been 2013, would it have been, or 2012? I'm not sure. 2013. And Pacquiao looked very good. but it was quite, it was fairly competitive, quite exciting. But Pacquiao, you thought was, I don't know, comfortable winner by four rounds. Don't even know what I'm banging on about here. But is this, is,
you're, do we, about Pacquiao Bradley.
Do we expect this? Do we expect this to be an exciting fight, or is it all about the spectacle? Is it all about, let's make the most of Manny Pacquiao?
So before this week, before I read this week's issue of Boxing News, I was thinking, do we need to see this? All the questions have been answered. We've seen this twice before. But then, after reading the magazine this week, it's like, on paper, this is a much more competitive fight than their second time around. You know, Pacquiao, maybe it was how good Mayweather was, or maybe Pacquiao's declined, but either way, the last time he boxed, he looked poor. Bradley is technically, you know, he's very, very good. He's not sort of, you know, he's not like a huge power puncher. He can go to war, he can box intelligently, and he beat Marquez, which is, Juan Manuel Marquez, it's a huge feather in his cap. But then I just don't know if Bradley isn't also in decline.
I agree.
You know, is he more vulnerable? Jesse Vargas really wobbled him before the strange ending of their fight. And again, Vargas has stopped very few people in his career, and I didn't think he was a massive puncher. Bradley's had wars. Brandon Rios, yes, he looked good against Rios, but Rios was terribly out of shape. I don't think anyone would have looked good. So I don't know
what you're talking about either, do you?
I rarely do. But I don't know if Teddy Atlas is going to be like a is Teddy Atlas going to be the key that he didn't have before in his failed attempts to get the better of Pacquiao? I don't know. So does that mean it's a good fight on paper? I genuinely don't know what's going to happen. You can argue it's a 50-50 fight. I think the problem is,
I've got no problem now with this fight. The one thing that is at the back of my mind is, if Pacquiao, and we kind of hope, what if Pacquiao comes out and he looks decent and he stops Bradley 8 or 9 rounds, there's no way in the world he'll retire, is there? Really? Come on.
All right. But you're a cynic. You don't believe anyone. I think Mayweather's going to stay retired. How do you feel about that? Boom. Denon said it.
Whoa. That is a risky comment to make at this point.
She said that's a risky comment to make to me.
No, I think, yeah. I mean, what you're saying there is that few people thought that Mayweather would stay retired. Mayweather has... would have more opportunities to come back than Pacquiao, yet Mayweather is quite happy just counting his cash and enjoying life, it seems.
As am I, mate.
Pacquiao's got quite a lot going on outside of boxing. But there was a little twinkle on this week where he said, look, you know, my intention now is to retire, but I don't know how I'm going to feel at the end of the fight.
Yeah.
Which is a bit of a get out of jail card, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. From saying that this was the last, from Pacquiao saying this is the end at his first press conference for this fight, to now he's saying, well, retirement's on my mind at the moment, but we'll see, is a sign that he's kind of rowing back from there. Yeah. But then it depends. If it's, you know, if he loses, if he struggles, you could see him retiring. If age is catching up with him, age and all his wars catching up with him. But then if it is, you know, a spectacular knockout, then suddenly Manny Pacquiao's back in business. His promoter, Bob Arum, doesn't want him to retire, does he?
No, of course he doesn't. I'm quite looking forward to this. I mean, you and I are both going to see Anthony Joshua tomorrow. I think by the time I get back to Brighton, it probably will be about the time of the ring walks for Pacquiao and Bradley, so I suspect that I'll be watching on the television.
I suspect at that time I'll be desperately trying to catch a night bus in Peckham or something.
hope you'd have got further than Peckham. But anyway, I mean, it's an interesting weekend. I mean, let's talk about the best news by some distance of the last 7 days, and that was that Nick Blackwell came out of his coma after his stupendous efforts against Chris Eubank Jr. Were you watching that fight live, the Blackwell fight?
No, so I was in Sheffield at the Kell Brook fight, so I haven't seen it. And then, you know, understandably, Channel 5 haven't put out sort of replays of the fight out of respect. So I haven't seen it. I saw some clips on a computer screen whilst mm-hmm. we were waiting for Kell Brook to come out, and Eubank Jr. did look very good, and it sounds like Blackwell was fighting back, but took some real punishment.
Yeah, that was kind of what I thought. I mean, as I was watching it, there was no point where I was just like, oh, this is dreadful. This has got to be stopped. But it's kind of now what happens with Nick Blackwell. I think I was talking to Ed Robinson today at the press conference, and he said, you know, let's see what Nick Blackwell, you know, how Nick Blackwell is now, and the fact that, first and foremost, he's while the whole of the boxing community has kind of been, you know, very saddened by what happened and praying that Nick Blackwell would make a recovery and kind of recover from the coma, is the fact that over the next few days, as Ed Robinson points out, he's got to come to terms with the fact that he lost the fight first and foremost, and then he's of course got probably the realization that he's never going to box again. So although it is all kind of good news that he's okay, for want of a better word, it's a long road ahead.
Yeah, well, he's still got to fully recover from his injuries, but it's just fantastic news that you know, that it wasn't as bad as people feared at the time.
As we feared, because that was horrible. It really was. Other news, Harold Graham as well, who, if you've been catching up with boxing news recently, you'll see that he was in hospital for quite a long period of time. He's out of hospital now. But for Harold as well, from what I can gather, it's quite a long road to recovery. But both Nick Blackwell and Harold Graham are very much in our thoughts, and we wish them all the very, very best. And I think when I say that, I'm speaking from everyone at Boxing News. We'll leave it at that. So next week, hopefully we'll be back next week, where we'll be able to talk about Joshua's coronation, or the fact that we've been overrating him all along.
Just left us on this cliffhanger, man.
Well, I'm sure you'll have an idea of which one of those two it is before you hear us again. But thanks always for your support, and thanks for listening.